We'll hear arguments first this morning in Secretary of State of Maryland against Joseph Munson Company. Ms. Motz, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. All of the issues raised in this case can, I believe, be stated in a single question, and that is a state statute which only limits the amounts a charity may spend on some of its fundraising expenses, and which provides the charity a complete exemption from even that limitation under certain circumstances, overbroad on its face in violation of the First Amendment. That is, has the statute been shown to have a substantial number of impermissible applications? This case comes to this Court on the Secretary of State of Maryland's petition for certiorari, asking this Court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which held such a statute facially overbroad. Maryland has substantial interests, both because of its parents' patriae responsibility with regard to charities and because of its obligations to protect its citizens, to ensure the integrity of charitable organizations. The statute, which was invalidated by the Court below, was enacted in response to precisely these concerns, as noted in its preamble. For prior to its enactment in 1976, Maryland law provided, as it does now, for annual registration and disclosure of certain information by non-exempt charitable organizations and paid solicitors, and for strict criminal penalties for fraudulent misrepresentations. However, the Maryland legislature determined that these measures were not sufficient in light of the activities of some ostensibly charitable organizations that had raised millions in contributions but had such excessively high expenses that little of that money had been used for charitable purposes.
Ms. Motz, at some point in your argument, are you going to discuss the standing question?
Yes, sir. I will address the standing question right now, Justice Rehnquist.
Whenever you had planned to get to it is fine. I was just hoping you would cover something about it.
Well, Justice Rehnquist, perhaps I can address it right now. I believe there are really sort of three standing questions here before the Court today. There is the question of whether there is a case or controversy. I don't think that there is really any dispute about that. It seems to me there clearly is. This is classically an adverse case. We have on one side the state who has its statute declared unconstitutional, and on the other side a party which may suffer possible criminal prosecution under the statute and which may suffer economic injury if the statute is in fact validated by this Court. The second type of standing that is at issue here is the jus tertii standing, the opportunity to present the rights of the Fraternal Order of Police by Munson in this case. It is the state's position that there is no jus tertii standing here. However, I'm not sure that that issue is terribly important except in one respect, and that is because in any event, Munson is going to have to demonstrate overbreadth. And it is the state's position that there is no overbreadth standing and there is not an overbreadth challenge on the merits here. And the determination of those two questions, it seems to me, are linked to the same kind of considerations.
Do you think the Maryland Court of Appeals ruling on standing was based on Maryland law or on federal law?
I believe it was clearly based on federal law, Your Honor.
They certainly cited most of the federal cases.
This is the first case in Maryland in which there was ever found any jus tertii standing. The first case. And it was based, I think, quite clearly on Craig versus Boren and a series of cases of this Court, and most particularly, of course, the Schomburg case. I was talking about the preamble to the legislation that we have at issue here. The Maryland legislature determined.
May I just ask one other question,
sir,
on standing? If you're right on standing, that there is no jus tertii, whatever you call it, standing, what should we do with the case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's very, very clear that the question of whether the real question here is whether there's overbreadth standing and overbreadth
challenge.
We
don't even have to reach that if we agree with you on jus tertii standing.
Well, I believe you do, because it seems to me that whether or not there is jus tertii standing, the respondent here can make an overbreadth challenge, separate and apart from any jus tertii standing. And it would be the state's submission that the overbreadth challenge is not a good challenge, that the merits determination on overbreadth should be a finding by this Court that this statute is not substantially overbroad, and this court should do exactly what it did in New York versus Ferber. That case came to you from the Court of Appeals of New York, highest court of the state, and that court found that the statute was indeed overbroad. This court reversed and sent it back to the state court for proceedings consistent with that reversal. And that's what I submit should be done here.
So really there's no difference in your view between the standing issue and the merits issue on the overbreadth question.
It took us a long time to get there, Justice Stevens, but that is in fact our position now. Yes, sir. The General Assembly, recognizing the activities of some ostensibly charitable organizations that had raised millions of dollars in contributions, but had had such excessively high expenses that little of that money had been used for charitable purposes, enacted reform legislation, of which the statute challenged here was a principal feature, to provide a more effective regulation over fundraising expenses without imposing an intolerable burden on charities, and, in the words of the preamble of the statute, to assure that contributions will be used to benefit the intended purpose. The challenge statute operates as follows. First, it provides that a charity may spend on fundraising expenses no more than 25% of the income raised by the fundraising activity. The statute, however, in no way limits a charity's administrative expenses. Thus, management overhead and general staff salaries are subjected to no limitation. In addition, the Maryland statute excludes from the fundraising limitation a number of major items which are ordinarily regarded as fundraising expenses. For example, the cost of all goods, food, drink, or entertainment sold or provided to the public, the cost of pre-planning and feasibility studies, and the cost of postage and printing are expressly excluded from the fundraising limitation and so may be freely incurred without limit. Moreover, a charity can gain a complete exemption from the 25% limitation when the limitation would effectively prevent the charity from raising contributions. And this exemption may be applied for even if the charity has already exceeded the fundraising limitation. Prior to the decision in the court below, Secretary of State's records show 14 organizations requested an exemption and 13 waivers from the 25% limitation were granted. If a waiver is granted, then a charity must disclose to the public every time it solicits, on the telephone, in the mail, or in person, that it has been granted a waiver from the 25% limitation and the amount that it has been authorized to spend or has spent on fundraising expenses. Of course, any decision denying a waiver is subject to judicial review. The respondent, Joseph P. Munson Company, at whose behest the court below held the statute I've just described unconstitutional, is an Indiana for-profit corporation whose sole business, according to its amended bill of complaint, is to advise charitable organizations how to go about promoting an entertainment event. Also, according to the bill of complaint, Munson regularly collects from charities for its services more than 25% of the income raised by these services. The firm's only client in Maryland is the Fraternal Order of Police, one of whose chapters, it has been stipulated, was reluctant to enter into a fundraising contract with Munson because of the 25% limitation at issue here. In this respect, it is significant that a number of other chapters of the same charity, the Fraternal Order of Police, have on several occasions applied for a waiver from the 25% limitation, and on each occasion the waiver has been granted. Finally, while it has been stipulated that the Fraternal Order of Police engages in the dissemination of information and the advocacy of causes on behalf of police officers, there is no stipulation, and the record shows no connection between such activities and the fundraising activities at which the Maryland statute is directed. The basis upon which
Mrs. Motz, may I ask you whether it's your position now that are there any limits in your view on the circumstances in which the exemption is available to a charity?
Yes, ma'am. I believe, Justice O'Connor, there are limits. In our view, the exemption is only available, as it says in the statute, when the charity can show that without the exemption, with the limitation, contributions would I don't have the words of the statute here, but in those instances in which the limitation would effectively prevent the charitable organization from raising contributions, in our view and in the practice before the Secretary, it is an economic determination. The Secretary has in front of her the case that the charity makes that they need the exemption for economic reasons. Now, there are any number of economic reasons for which the charity has granted the exemption. A new organization, an organization with new activities, an organization with a new program, an organization that wants to pursue a program in a different way, a one-time or extraordinary expense, any one of those kinds of things, but they are all economically grounded.
May I ask you what that means, the effectively prevent from raising contributions? Does it mean they couldn't raise any contributions or they would raise less money without the limitation?
I think that the practice has been they would raise less money. They've had an unsuccessful track record. They haven't been able to raise —
as long as they can show that by exceeding the limit, they would raise an extra dollar, then if they didn't have the 25%, they'd be exempt.
Well, Justice Stevens, I'm not sure that I would go that far, but the Secretary has been liberal in granting the exemptions. And if a charity comes in with a showing
— How many of these exemptions were granted before this lawsuit was filed?
There were 14 organizations that requested an exemption, and 13 of those were granted.
And how many before this lawsuit was filed?
Before this lawsuit — well, the lawsuit was filed in 1978. For 2 years, nothing happened at all.
So those are all post-litigation exemptions?
Post the beginning of this litigation.
Yeah.
The statute was not enacted until 1976. Mm-hmm. And so the regulations, in fact, were not promulgated until February of 78. So that it has taken a while to get a record, if
yeah.
you will, of the practice here.
Do you feel the regulations are consistent with the statute as interpreted by your highest court?
I do, Your Honor. Our highest court said, which is, it seems to me, is absolutely true, that the regulations can go no further than the statute. I mean, that's a matter that this court and indeed every court I'm familiar with has ever held. And we believe that the way in which those regulations have been interpreted by the Secretary, the practice is entirely consistent with the statute and has gone no further than the statutory authority. And indeed, respondent makes no contention to the contrary. His contention is not that the regulations go further than the statute. He simply says that the regulations and the statute don't give enough discretion, don't give enough exemption authority.
I think if you're satisfied with the so-called narrow interpretation of the statute, I guess you have to be.
I think that's right, Justice Blackmun. I have no. The General Assembly has spoken, it seems to me.
Ms. Motz, I'd like to ask you a question about the statute. Also, on page 8 of your brief, you say there's no limit whatever on administrative expenses.
That's right, Justice Calder.
Will you tell me about some of the normal administrative expenses? What about salaries of personnel who work in the headquarters, say, of the United Fund?
Those expenses, those salaries, are not touched by the Maryland statute.
Nor is rent.
No,
nor
sir.
Nor is travel expense of executives?
No, sir.
What is touched?
What is touched are what is defined as explicitly fundraising expenses. And the way the Maryland statute directs that a charity, that these be allocated, is consistent with standards of the
Could you give some illustration? Printing is not included.
Printing of materials that are mailed is not included. Printing of other materials is included. The cost of telephone solicitors is included.
What about radio?
Radio costs, advertising costs. Yes, sir. All of those are limited by the exemption, or by the limitation.
Yes.
But none of what would standard be thought of as administrative costs, attorney's fees, bookkeeping, the salaries of people that are at headquarters, researchers, none of that is touched by the Maryland statute.
What if the organization just hires a fundraiser and the fundraiser charges a fee or a percentage? I suppose that would be covered.
That would be covered, Justice White, except if the fundraiser was doing a feasibility or pre-planning study. If the professional fundraiser, if they were doing that kind of study, that expense is expressly excluded from the fundraising limitation.
What about expense accounts of the staff?
The staff of the charity, for example.
The expense accounts.
Of the United Fund, for example, the charity's expense accounts, the administrative expense accounts.
I'm talking about unlimited expense accounts.
Sir, if they
are. Where you raise money for somebody and you don't charge any fee, but your expense accounts run about twice what you raise.
I don't think that problem. Well, if all that this person does.
You evidently don't have some of the sharp ones down here.
Well, I don't suggest, Justice Marshall, that this statute covers every problem. I think if that person is only working on soliciting contributions, then the expense account money would indeed be covered by this limitation. If that person is working in the central staff office on administration, his expense account would not be.
Let's assume that that in this case there was a specific request for an exemption which was denied, and then this suit is brought, and I suppose you would say that the state's interest in enforcing this statute is sufficient to override the whatever First Amendment interest there is here.
Well, in point of fact, we don't have any showing here.
I know. I said let's assume there's no overbreadth issue whatsoever. It's just that this charity says this is what it does to me, and I would suppose your position has to be that the state's interest in that is sufficient to warrant the statute.
Well, Justice White, if we assume further that the group that is denied the waiver is an advocacy organization, then I think that I don't necessarily think that the Maryland statute can be applied constitutionally. I don't think it necessarily would be applied unconstitutionally. I think that would be a matter for case-by-case determination. We're talking about an advocacy group.
Well, if the statute as applied to some advocacy groups would be unconstitutional, I take it you're saying it might be.
I'm saying that it
is
possible.
If an exemption were forbidden, or if there was a prosecution for raising money without a permit of some advocacy organizations, the statute would be unconstitutionally. Is that right?
I'm not sure of that, Your Honor. I think that it is possible.
But I take it then we should judge the case as though that were the case, because unless you want to take a position on it.
let me try to articulate my position on it. I think that the position I would say, Justice White, is that there's been no showing here, that I think it is highly unlikely that this statute is ever going to be applied unconstitutionally against any group.
Well, you say there that you can imagine some advocacy groups which statute could not be applied constitutionally.
No, sir. I thought that I was taking your hypothetical, which was an advocacy group that had been denied the exemption.
All right. I'll take that. And then an advocacy group denied the exemption, and without the permit, they can't raise money. Now, you would say that in some circumstances the statute could not be applied.
I think that it is arguable that the statute would be unconstitutional. I think it's highly unlikely that the advocacy group is ever going to be denied the exemption. The advocacy group can make it.
On your submission, then, we must assume that in some circumstances the statute could not be constitutionally applied.
I think that one can assume here, as one did in Broderick, that it is possible the statute may have a limited number of impermissible applications.
Well, how do you avoid the overbreadth argument then?
Well, it seems to me that we avoid it exactly as it was avoided in Broderick, that the chance, that the likelihood of that happening is so infinitesimal that we would reserve that case to a case-by-case determination. And if there was ever a statute built for a case-by-case determination, I submit, Justice White, it is this one.
Well, did your court agree with your assessment?
Well, no, sir. That's why we're here before you.
Well, I know, but don't they know more about the possibilities of
in the great state of Maryland than we do?
Well, I think, Justice White, what they did was try to apply the Schomburg analysis in a mechanistic way and not look at the true and substantial differences between this case and Schomburg. It is the state's submission that the Schomburg holding does not require invalidation of the Maryland statute.
You're not suggesting that the author of Broderick and the author of Schomburg disagree with one another, are you?
Well, I would certainly hope not, Justice Rehnquist. I'm dismayed that there might be a chance of that. And that's why I'll try to address that point right now. That is because we submit that there are substantial, significant differences between the statute we have here and the ordinance in Schomburg. Perhaps the most obvious one is that while the Schomburg Ordinance was a direct regulation of door-to-door solicitation, conduct which has been recognized as often so intertwined with advocacy as to be protected under the First Amendment, the Maryland statute is not directed to door-to-door solicitation, but rather at charitable fundraising expenses. Fundraising, as you know, may be conducted in a variety of ways that has nothing to do with advocacy, like dances, garden tours, bingo games, things like this, and of course the entertainment shows, which are the specialty of the respondent here. Now, true, fundraising may include solicitation intertwined with advocacy. This is the point we were getting at earlier. But there is no showing here that any solicitation intertwined with advocacy has been or will be or is likely to be threatened by the Maryland statute, or that any group engaging in any solicitation intertwined with advocacy has even needed to apply for a waiver from the fundraising limitation, let alone been denied one. The second important difference, I think, between this statute and the ordinance in Schomburg is the situation that I was discussing with Justice Powell a few minutes ago, and that is the fact that the Schomburg ordinance limited a charity to limited its administrative as well as fundraising expenses. That is, general staff salaries, rents, telephones, attorney's fees, all of those general expenses were limited by the Schomburg Ordinance as well as fundraising expenses. The Maryland statute does not attempt to limit the administrative expenses. Rather, it attempts to strike at the heart of the problem of excessive fundraising without unduly intruding into the internal affairs of a charitable organization by limiting only fundraising expenses. Thirdly, the Schomburg Ordinance required a charity prior to any solicitation to obtain a permit, and in order to obtain the permit, the charity had to prove that at least 75% of its income in the previous year had been used directly for charitable purposes. Thus, there was no way a charity could, in the words of this Court, alter its spending patterns in the short term to comply with the 75% requirement. The Maryland statute imposes neither of these serious burdens on a charity. First, it does not require a charity to prove compliance with the percentage limitation prior to engaging in fundraising activities. And second, the Maryland statute allows a charity to apply the limitation retrospectively on an annual or campaign-by-campaign basis, and so that even in the short run, a charity can indeed alter its spending patterns to comply with the Maryland statute. Fourth, the Schomburg Ordinance flatly banned solicitation by charities that spent more than a certain percentage on non-program expenses. In contrast, the Maryland statute simply subjects expenses in excess of the percentage limitation to scrutiny. If a charity can demonstrate the limitation effectively prevents it from raising funds, it can obtain a complete exemption from the waiver, something which was simply impossible under the Schomburg Ordinance.
May I ask a question that's based on something you said earlier? You said complete exemption. When they get the exemption and then they thereafter solicit, are they required by the terms of the exemption to disclose the fact that over... So it's really not a complete exemption.
It is not a – well, it's a complete exemption, but there is a disclosure requirement.
And I take it the thought behind the disclosure requirement is that would avoid any danger of fraudulent arrangement.
It would let the prospective donor know exactly what the situation is.
Yes, sir. Happening. Why would not such a blanket requirement of disclosure whenever over 25% is used for administrative expenses. Why would that not adequately serve the state's interest in avoiding fraud?
Well, I think there are two reasons, Justice Stevens. First, and probably the one that is most persuasive to us, is that I'm just not sure disclosure really works. In a variety of situations, from cigarette packs to securities regulation, disclosure, no matter how full it is, no matter when it's given, just simply doesn't really do the trick all the time. Now, it is a part of our statute. It's hoped that it does inform donors.
How can you say it doesn't do the trick? Maybe it doesn't prevent people from buying cigarettes, but they're not being defrauded if they know the risks involved in the purchase.
Well, the problem...
That's your only interest, is to avoid the risk of fraud, as I understand it.
Well, the problem here, though, is that it raises, telling people we spend 10% on fundraising expenses raises more questions than it answers. It tells people that, and then it immediately invites questions. And the person that is often doing the soliciting is either a volunteer who doesn't know very much about the inner workings of the charity or why 10%, whether 10% is high or whether 10% is low, or a paid solicitor paid at a minimum wage rate who is in the same situation, although for different reasons. And it's the charities themselves who have almost across the board, I notice they don't say it in their amici briefs to this court, but they have, for example, testified before the Maryland General Assembly that disclosure requirements, point of solicitation disclosure requirements, raise more questions than they answer and therefore put an undue burden on the charity and don't give the public the real story. Now, I think there is some truth in that, Your Honor. I think they tell you something. They don't tell you everything, and they are not, it seems to us, they're not as protective of Maryland's interests as the statute we have here. And we believe the statute we have here does not impose very much burden, more burden on charities than that would. Finally, it is the state's position that the court below not only erred in failing to recognize the substantive differences between the ordinance struck down in Schomburg and the statute involved here, but it also failed to apply the correct test of validity, the test that was applied by this court in Schomburg, the substantial overbreadth test. In Schomburg, this court held that the ordinance bad because it constituted a substantial limitation on protected activity. Subsequent to the decision in Schomburg, this court has reiterated the test of substantiality in New York versus Ferber, where it said that a statute would be stricken as overbroad under the First Amendment only if it were shown to have a substantial number of impermissible applications. There is no showing in this case that the Maryland statute has had, will have, or is likely to have any impermissible applications.
Except in the opinion of your court.
The Court of Appeals decision, Justice White, rests entirely upon conjecture. There is neither the respondent, nor the Fraternal Order of Police, nor any of the amici who have presented a point of view to this court has shown that the statute has limited or threatens to limit the dissemination of information or the advocacy of ideas. If I could compare the Court of Appeals
you
decision...
You think the overbreadth argument must always be supported by evidence in the record?
Sir, I don't think it need be supplied by evidence in the record. I think in order to show substantial overbreadth, one must find that it is realistic to expect that the statute will, in fact, be overbroad. Here I submit it is not realistic to expect that. I think that one has to...
So what do we say, if we agree with you, what do we say about the conclusion of the Court of Appeals about the substantiality of the overbreadth? Just say it's just wrong because we know more about... We've got better judicial notice than they have.
I think what you say is that it is... While in Schomburg, it was likely, it was almost inevitable. Indeed, this court found that there was a group to which this statute could not constitutionally be applied. I think it is impossible, particularly with the waiver provision, to ever find that about this statute, that there is a group to which it cannot constitutionally be applied. It simply isn't here. That is a question of federal constitutional law, I submit. If there are no further questions, I think I'll try to reserve my remaining time.
Very well. Mr. Goldberg.
Mr. Chief Justice Berger, the court's permission. First, if I may, let me say that notwithstanding the remarks contained in the reply brief filed by the petitioner, neither the respondent or any of the amici suggest to this honorable court or to anyone else that state doesn't have a right to regulate in this area, because truly, surely, it does. Nor shall I come before you today to re-argue the Schomburg case. I don't think it needs re-argument. I think your findings in the Schomburg case were quite clear. I would submit to you that if you look at the statute in the Schomburg case, that is that portion of it which sets up the, in that case, 75% formula, and in the case of the state of Maryland, the 25% exemption, I think you'll find them substantially the same. You'll find some allocations of cost slightly different. But their intrusiveness on First Amendment rights are almost equal. And I say the word almost because it is my contention that the Maryland statute is not, in fact, less intrusive of First Amendment rights, but in fact, more intrusive of First Amendment rights.
Now, going back to your statement that the states do have the power to regulate, the
yes,
constitutional power, do you mean by that if the states said that at least 50% of the money must go to the charitable organization, that the expenses can't exceed 50%, that might be satisfactory?
No. No, indeed, Mr.
How about
Chief.
75?
I'm sorry, sir.
If 25% must go to the principal, that the expenses can't exceed 75%, what about that?
Your Honor, respectfully, I would suggest that any percentage, any, whether the percentage were 25, 50, 75,
Even 90.
Yes, sir. In fact, you raise a point that was raised in the court below when it was asked of me, suppose 90% was the determinative factor. And I said to the court below, in the Court of Appeals of Maryland, that any percentage that takes away the right of the public to make its own decision whether or not to contribute to a particular organization or cause or whatever advocacy group, such a percentage would be invalid, period. Why do I say that? Because the purpose of these statutes, all of them, Schomburg statute, by the utterance of counsel here this morning, this statute, they're designed to help prevent fraud.
Well, Mr. Goldberg, what if a legislature were to say that our statute is not only designed to prevent fraud, but we think it's against public policy for charitable solicitors to make 90% of what they take? So even if they completely disclose it, we're not going to let them operate in Maryland. Do you think that would be unconstitutional?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I think that would be just as intrusive, and with your permission, Justice Rehnquist, I'd like to tell you why.
Well, what do you mean by intrusive? Is there something in the Constitution that says an ordinance can't be intrusive?
Well, no, Your Honor, but if it is, it has to be minimally intrusive of a First Amendment right of freedom of speech. And I would suggest to this Court an example of what I'm talking about. I would suggest to this Court if this year, as an example, the particular charity was succeeded in raising $10,000, a particular advocacy group, and they did it right within the 25% limitation that was provided by the Maryland statute, and everybody was happy. And the next year they decided, well,
We want to bring our message across to a greater number of people. We want to raise more money. And instead of using the mail as we had done before, and perhaps a few speeches around town, the Super Bowl's coming up, and we want to take some time and buy some advertisement, and we want to raise $250,000. Well, our cost on there, it looks like it's going to be about $750,000. Well, we'll pay the $750,000 because we're going to raise $250,000. So as a result, we have gone far beyond the Maryland statute. But what we haven't done, Your Honor, is committed any fraud. And there is no implication of fraud.
Well, but you seem to insist that only fraud can be a permissible motive, legislative motive for a statute like this. Certainly a state can regulate the fees charged by employment agencies, can it not? Regardless of how much the employment agency discloses, it can say, whatever you disclose, you still can't collect a referral fee of more than 10%. Isn't that so?
Your Honor, that is so, but I don't think it's applicable in the area of First Amendment and freedom of speech.
Well, what if a state said that we think literary agents are just getting too much money from authors, and so we're going to forbid any literary agent from collecting more than 10% by way of a commission from the author's royalties on a book. Now, supposing you could make all the showing that the agents had been kind of getting grabby, the sort of thing, same sort of thing you make for an employment agency. Do you think there's anything wrong under the Constitution with that statute?
I think, Your Honor, that it conceivably could be challenged, yes.
All statutes conceivably could be challenged.
Yes.
What do you think that would be the outcome of a challenge?
I, frankly, Your Honor, would feel that perhaps the outcome of the statute, I think, would be declared perhaps unconstitutional as an unjustified intrusion into the right to deal freely in business in the absence of any suggestion of fraud or wrongdoing. We have a marketplace system here in our society.
Well, if that analysis is true, the cases holding that the regulation of employment agency fees must be wrong if it's just a marketplace analysis.
Your Honor, I don't stand before this court and suggest that I would be a sage in suggesting that I would agree or disagree with all past holdings of this court or any other court and hope that what my position is with respect to a particular issue is the correct one. I address myself to those issues this morning that have to do with a statute which is baldly on its face, overly broad, in that it reaches out and sweeps in organizations who have a right of freedom of speech and presentation. We're dealing with a percentage statute, and I know the statement that I've made in response to the Chief Justice's statement is a rather strong one, but nonetheless, when you're talking about First Amendment rights, I think it has been the tradition of this court to be very, very strong in its protection of those rights. I would suggest that not only is the statute in Maryland stronger in the sense of that it violates First Amendment rights to a greater extent. If you compare the Village of Schaumburg statute, it only really related to door-to-door solicitation. Though the court didn't rest its opinion on the door-to-door permit requirement. In the Maryland statute, may I draw your attention to the fact that the solicitation is any form of solicitation, whether it be by radio broadcast, whether it be by telephone, whether it be by mail, or whatever media.
Well, Maryland wasn't attempting to tell them how to do it. It wasn't addressing specific methods, as in Schomburg, but going back to your statement that the state has a constitutional authority to regulate, could you give some examples of what you think would be reasonable or constitutional regulation?
Certainly, Your Honor. I don't have the statute here before me, but I'm quite sure it's the statute which is in effect in Indiana that I had occasion to take a look at, which is a very strict disclosure statute which requires an organization to present a statement of its financial affairs in connection with all contributions made to it. I would further suggest to the court that, as this court stated in its Schomburg decision, there are many, many very, very strong penal statutes that can be drawn, and some have been drawn already, which deal with fraud. If fraud is the thing that raises the concern of the state, as well it should.
Well, let me put this hypothetical to you. Suppose Maryland's provided in its statute that during the period of the solicitation, the soliciting organization and the ultimate beneficiary must publish once a week in the local newspaper the record of the last previous solicitation as to how much it cost to raise the money, how much of it was going to the charitable organization and how much was going to the promoters. Would that be a valid regulation?
I would suggest to the court, if I understood your question correctly, and I think it was whether or not if they required them to do it on a weekly basis, would that be a fair statute?
So that the people who are being solicited would understand where their money is going.
I would suggest to the court, Your Honor, that in that form, such a disclosure law might be considered overburdensome in that not knowing what funds that they were going to be able to obtain to expend the monies necessary to effectively publish in a, I would suppose, a local paper on a weekly basis might be in itself such a heavy obligation as itself to be prohibitive. On the other hand, to require an organization to give out to a prospective donor a statement of what it has done with its money, I see no problem with that whatsoever. And I think it's entirely within the proper realm for a state to so regulate, and doesn't, on its face at any rate, appear that there would result any infringement of First Amendment rights.
Well, how much publication would you have to give?
Your Honor, in the statute, in effect...
I mean, on your statement you just said, it would be perfectly all right to compel them to make a public disclosure. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
How often? And how detailed?
Your Honor, I wouldn't suggest that I know the answer to that question. However, I would suggest this. Some jurisdictions, that is, some states, I have been advised, though I don't know the particular states, publish this information as a public service in behalf of...
That's not my question. My question is, the statute compels the organization to disclose it. You said you agreed with that.
Yeah. Yes,
well,
I do.
How often? Once every 1,000 years?
No, sir. Absolutely not. I would suggest, Your Honor, if you had such a statute that if they were compelled to forward a copy of their financial statement of the preceding year, I think that would certainly be fair and adequate.
I thought you said to the public.
Sir?
I thought you said they could be compelled to report to the public not some agency.
If they were compelled to report to the public, Your Honor, I would suggest that once a year would not be unreasonable.
And how much detail? For example, unlimited expense accounts, would that be included?
Your Honor, I honestly can't address that to you because how
you
detailed
represent-
a statute, how detailed a statute a state ultimately
you,
comes.
You really didn't mean what you said. You meant to give it to the public on your turn.
No, sir. No, sir, that's not what I meant at all. Not what I meant at all. I am not a legislature, a legislator. I have seen statutes such as the Indianapolis, Indiana statute, which requires the information to be given at the time a solicitation is made and a donor agrees to give money. That would appear to me.
Did you ever look at the New York statute?
Sir?
Did you ever look at the New York?
No, sir, I have not.
The Indiana one.
Well, it was forwarded to me, Your Honor.
Court,
please.
I see.
And I would take a few moments at this time to further try to distinguish the two statutes. It is our position that, of course, the Maryland statute is truly overbroad and stands four square alongside that statute in the Schomburg case. And it is
well, Mr. Goldberg, what about the exemptions that are allowed under the Maryland statute? Isn't that a substantial difference?
Thank you, Justice O'Connor. I was just coming to that very point, and I would suggest to you that these, or this, quote, limited exemption provision doesn't cleanse this statute of any overbreath. In fact, this exemption further burdens this statute to a point that I would suggest is, based on the law of this court in the past, is just totally unacceptable. It leaves a clear-cut discretion in the hands of the Secretary of the State of Maryland. You know, they can say, as frequently as they might like, that we have given 14 exceptions. All someone has to do is come in and apply. Well, that's what's been done today, and that's what was done yesterday. But what we don't know is, and what we cannot allow to be speculated upon, is what's going to be done tomorrow. Perhaps tomorrow an organization will come in who is not particularly favored by this particular Secretary of State, and then we
well,
go.
Would you say the Maryland statute would be fine under Schomburg if the exemption provisions set forth some standards?
Your Honor, I would suggest to this Court that any attempt at curing the overbreath by way of an exemption provision, which in itself leaves a discretion in the administrative body, that is, a Secretary of State or other administrative officer, notwithstanding there that there may be an appeal to a judicial body, is no less offensive, in fact perhaps more offensive, of First Amendment rights as anything possibly could be, because you are talking about leaving discretion, and I refer now to Justice Rehnquist's dissent in the Schomburg case, in which he so eloquently pointed it out, that it's almost academic, that you don't, if you have First Amendment, a First Amendment right involved, you cannot have discretion The Maryland courts have interpreted the statute, which, as the court pointed out earlier, the state unfortunately is bound with, that it is much too narrow, so that it does not, in any wise at all, clear up the issue of overbreath, which is so terribly apparent in the other portion of the statute.
May I ask you a question right there?
Yes, sir.
If your position is the statute is overbroad and the exemption doesn't help, I take it you are arguing that even if you had applied for an exemption and you had received the exemption and you were able to solicit on behalf of this organization, you would still have the same lawsuit that you'd be able to maintain.
I'm sorry, sir. I didn't hear.
You would still make your overbreath attack on this statute even if you had applied for an exemption and obtained an exemption. Is that correct?
Of course.
Why didn't you ask for an exemption then?
Because, Your Honor, we didn't feel that the statute was constitutional. We didn't feel that...
But you wouldn't have lost your right to challenge it.
That's very true, Your Honor, but then again...
You might have been able to solicit in the meantime.
You don't have to, when a First Amendment, when a statute is being challenged on First Amendment grounds, you don't have to have a violation of that statute. We have what was generally referred to in these cases as a chilling effect, which gives us the right to come in and test these statutes. Here, Your Honor, as an example, an advocacy group doesn't want to run the risk of challenging that statute. They don't want to have the stigma of fraud pointed in their face because they have violated the statute, have now come back, and have now asked...
I understand all that, but it doesn't explain to me why you wouldn't have applied for the exemption. And maybe you don't have to, but it's just kind of curious.
Well, Your Honor, we didn't apply for the exemption because, frankly, sir, we didn't feel we had to. We felt that the statute was wrong, the statute was unconstitutional, and therefore we did not apply for the exemption on those grounds. We weren't required to apply for that exemption, and in fact did not. No more than one would have to apply for a permit when they were out in the street canvassing books in connection with particular types of religious beliefs. I believe, if my memory serves me, a case comes to mind, the Cantwell case. A more recent case, the Haynes case versus Ordell. Mr. Haynes could have gone and sought a permit, but he didn't. He went out door to door and solicited for his particular campaign because that statute, he felt, was overly broad and facially unconstitutional, and therefore he wasn't required to do so. And, Your Honor, that is exactly the position in this particular matter. Now, I think perhaps I've, by Your Honor's questions, I've covered most of the ground that I intended to try and cover here this morning.
Mr. Goldberg, may I ask a question?
Certainly, sir.
The stipulation states that the Fraternal Order of Police that you represent is engaged in advocating causes. I'm generally familiar with the orders of police in my state of Virginia, and they serve a very useful purpose. Tell me specifically what causes your client advocates.
Well, Your Honor, the Fraternal Order of Police has evolved in the past few years, I would suppose, in as much as a voice of the police officers in connection with work-related activities that is almost in the form of a union chapter, if you will, expressing the views of the police officers as to working conditions, as to benefits that might be obtainable by them, and in an area that's terribly important.
So the cause is to improve employment conditions of police?
Not entirely, Your Honor. Also, they spend a good deal of time in connection with the field of relations between the police department and the public, establishing better relationships, working together so that the police officer is not looked upon as this onerous person in a blue uniform, but really as he had been looked upon in years gone by.
Mr. Public Relations Program.
Sir?
Public Relations Program.
Public Relations Program.
How is that put on, by radio, television, newspaper ads, or what?
Your Honor, each chapter does it, I would presume, in their own way. They promote certain local affairs. They go out and participate in local affairs. I believe that's how it's done. With particularity, I'm sure I cannot answer it, as for each chapter.
Mr. Goldberg, are any of the funds used directly to benefit aged police or police whose disability benefits are not adequate to take care of them?
Yes, Your Honor, that is another area.
But tell me this, do you have to file any report at all of how the money is expended?
As of this time, whether or not the Montgomery County chapter has filed such a report, I cannot answer because I want to make
Maryland,
it very clear.
Maryland law. Does
Sir?
Maryland law require the filing of any report to anyone?
I can tell you that my client, the respondent, the Munson Organization, has not filed such a report.
But you don't know what Maryland law provides?
As to the filing of a report?
Yes.
Absolutely I do. The filing of a report...
I'm not talking about this statute. I'm thinking, for example, about reports that corporations have to file, certain corporations that have listed stock that disclose the assets and liabilities and the income of each year and a vast amount of information. I was wondering whether in Maryland, for example, that's a stated issue, any report of any kind is required to be filed by a charitable organization. Is the answer no?
Well, Your Honor, the answer, I'm not saying the answer is no. But what I am saying is that I am not familiar with it.
You don't know.
I do know that under the statute which we have here before us, there is a requirement of filing of complete financial information, yes.
Would you object to that?
No, absolutely not.
And do you know, for example, what percentage of the funds raised by your client go to the direct benefit of police who are needy or otherwise need the money?
Sir,
I'm thinking about the distinction between advocating causes and providing relief for needy policemen.
Your Honor, I don't know what the variation is, what the percentage is between how much goes to the policeman who is incapacitated and how much goes to the public relations or just where the line is or what percentage is on what part of the line.
You're not able to tell us with any figures or even any rough estimates as to what extent this organization is a cause advocacy organization. I'm talking now in terms of percent of money raised.
Your Honor,
if you don't know, just
I
say
don't,
you
don't know, sir, right. And I don't want to speculate, sir.
Mr. Goldberg,
yes, sir.
Well, one thing is clear, that your client is not a charitable organization.
The Munson Organization?
Yes, sir.
No question about it, sir.
It is not.
It is not, sir. That is quite correct. But I would suggest, Your Honor, that not only does this statute reach advocacy organizations as the FOP, but reaches all advocacy organizations. We're not here today merely talking about or seeking the assistance of this court in connection with the Fraternal Order Police. Our whole position is that this statute sweeps so broadly that it sweeps into it all advocacy organizations, just as did the Schomburg case, and that the, quote, limited exception, the exception limitation doesn't cleanse it. And what's more, not only does it not cleanse it, as again I refer to Justice Rehnquist's dissent in the Schomburg case, it makes it worse because it leaves discretion in a place where discretion should not be when you're testing the constitutionality of a statute to the First Amendment standard. It simply cannot be there.
Your time has expired, Mr. Goldberg. Do you have anything further, Ms. Motz?
I have just one point, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you very much. I would like to make one point about the interest that the state is asserting here, and I feel that I may have unfortunately misled the court. The interests we are asserting here are somewhat different, I think, than the interests that were asserted in the Schomburg case. You remember in Schomburg, the village asserted that the fraud interest, and they asserted that those people who spent more than 25% on non-charity expenses were fraudulent in representing themselves as a charity. The state of Maryland makes no such contention. Indeed, what this statute is trying to reach is the use of charitable contributions for non-charitable purposes, something which may not necessarily be, and which probably in many instances is not, criminal fraudulent misrepresentation under an ordinary fraud statute. What it is, we submit, is something which entitles the state to be on notice as to the activities of the organization and to scrutinize those activities when their fundraising expenses are more than 25%. And that is precisely what the Maryland statute does. It does not assume that those activities are fraudulent. What it does is assume that they are entitled to be scrutinized by the state, and if the charity makes a showing that indeed those expenses are reasonable, it may go out and continue to solicit, provided it discloses that to the public. And if it does not make that showing, then it is not entitled to solicit. Of course, that decision goes to judicial review. We believe in that way, without imposing any great burden on the charity, we have protected the potential donor, the intended beneficiary, and we have in general benefited charities by ensuring the appearance as well as the reality of integrity of charitable organizations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...